Hey folks, whether you're caring for patients in the OR or managing unstable airways in the ICU, you know it's the unexpected high-stakes airways that stay with you. The ones where decision-making, technique, and team communication make all the difference. And if you want to be prepared for these situations, I highly recommend you check out the Difficult Airway Course, a hands-on airway course designed for clinicians managing high-risk airways. The Difficult Airway Course offers accredited hands-on training with specialty-specific courses designed for anesthesia, critical care, and emergency medicine. The focus is on practical, immediately applicable skills, including airway assessment and planning, video laryngoscopy, fiber optic techniques, peri-intubation optimization, and managing failed or rapidly evolving airways. What sets the course apart is the format: small group hands-on workshops and realistic code airway scenarios led by a world-class faculty. Courses are offered four times this year, in March and November in San Diego, May in Boston, and September in Atlanta. Space is limited, so groups stay small, with plenty of opportunity for questions and conversations with faculty. So if you're looking to sharpen your airway skills, whether you're early in your practice or many years in, visit theairwaysite.com to find your course and register. As a bonus, our listeners can use code ACRAC26 to save $100 on registration. That's theairwaysite.com and use code ACRAC26. Hey there, ACRACers. I want to tell you about a CME conference that I will be speaking at in the new year from February 28th to March 7th, 2026. It is an amazing conference. It is the Holiday Seminars Conference in Maui at the Hyatt Regency Maui Resort and Spa. I have been there before. I've spoken at this before, and it is incredible. The family, the Smith family that puts this on, they really do an incredible job. It's going to be some amazing speakers. It's a beautiful hotel and an opportunity to really enjoy Hawaii and Maui, and especially at a time when Maui is trying to recover from the wildfires. They're really going all out to try to make the tourist experience an amazing one. So I think this is a great year to come, and the conference is going to be incredible. You're going to hear from amazing speakers who are going to go over really, really high-yield topics. I highly, highly recommend signing up for this. You can go to holidayseminars.com and click on the Maui link, and you can register there. You can use CME money. It is going to be amazing. So I hope I will get a chance to see you there. It'll be a ton of fun. Hello, and welcome back to ACRAC. I'm Jed Wolpaw, and I am thrilled to have a fabulous show for you today. This will be a really great follow-up to the show we did a couple months ago on civility in healthcare. I've got with me two wonderful, wonderful guests who are going to talk about a system called Name, Claim, Aim. And it's really about building teams, making effective teams work, and finding your voice. I'm really excited to learn more from them about this, and I think this will be really useful for everybody. I've got Dr. Rebecca Meinhardt. She is an associate professor of anesthesiology at the Alpert School of Medicine at Brown University, as well as the chief of obstetric anesthesia at Women's and Infants Hospital, and the vice chair for faculty development. Rebecca has dedicated her academic and clinical career to establishing new educational techniques to foster more productive conversations in high-stakes, time-limited circumstances. Right, perfect for what we're going to talk about today. And also Dr. Lon Setnick. Lon is an emergency physician and a simulation educator with over 20 years of experience in clinical care, leadership, and medical education. Currently, he serves as the director of clinical programs at the Center for Medical Simulation. He holds appointments as a part-time lecturer in anesthesia at Harvard Medical School and clinical assistant professor in emergency medicine at University of New England College of Osteopathic Medicine. His professional focus lies in advancing psychological safety, systems improvement, and experiential education to foster excellence in healthcare. I'm thrilled to have them both here. Welcome to the show, both of you.
All right.
Thank you so much.
So let's start with maybe a story of where you have used this framework, Name, Claim, Aim, recently. I think that'll be a way to help people understand what it is and then launch us into what we want to talk about it. Rebecca, do you want to tell us some way in which you've used it recently?
I would love to. So for a disclaimer, like we started this work, 8-10 years ago, and it has been evolving over time. And so I had used it in my prior job quite often. I was at the Massachusetts General Hospital for many years and recently moved to Brown, and they weren't familiar with the Name, Claim, Aim paradigm at all. And so but the beauty of it is that you don't need to be familiar with it in order to communicate and to organize your team really effectively. So I came in, I was taking overnight call for Women and Infants Hospital, and we had an emergency cord prolapse that was coming to the operating room. And so I was alerted. I brought my team in the room. We met with the scrub nurses and the obstetrician who was coming in. And actually, there's been a culture shift in the group that since our group came in, the hospital now, we do more general anesthetics for these emergency cases than they used to. And so, but the culture is still adjusting to that change, although they're supportive of it. So when I came into the room, I sort of wanted to, it's just what I'm used to doing. So I said, I'm just going to name this as an emergency cesarean delivery for cord prolapse under general anesthesia. And I started to go through the other things like the, claiming the roles and the aiming the team, like we'll induce general anesthesia. And then I will direct you when it's time for you to cut, which I like to use that clear language. And so that, that happened. Afterwards, the obstetrician came to me and said, oh my gosh, it was so amazing that you said that, because in the moments when I came in the room, I actually wasn't sure what kind of anesthesia was going to be. I wasn't sure what kind of negotiation I would have to have with you, because I saw this as a real emergency, and you just clarified everything up front and we were on the same page, and it was just such a beautiful thing. And I thought that was really remarkable, because it showed a couple things. First, it helped the organization of the room during really a time pressured circumstance. And second, it built, I mean, I didn't know her very well. And for her to come up to me and say, like, now we have this bond of strengthening the team because we're on the same page. And it was so obvious to her that we were on the same page. And it just like sort of promoted all of that good teamwork in the moment. So I think it was really impactful. And I loved it because it wasn't with a culture who had been practicing it for, you know, the years and years of doing crisis resource management at my old place.
Yeah, that's fabulous. Lon, how about you?
I had a experience where I received a burn trauma patient at a community hospital that's not used to receiving burn trauma patients. And the patient had a head injury. He had IV access, but no vital signs had been obtained en route because he was too agitated. And we were trying to get control of the scene. And there were actually multiple patients at the same time. So I was working with a group of teammates that I wasn't used to, ICU nurse and, hospital resources, OR nurses. And we set up for everything, but I asked the nurse to just push some ketamine so we could get control of the situation and then get vital signs and then go step by step. About 30 seconds after she pushed the ketamine, the patient stopped moving and stopped breathing. And so I noticed this and I said, hold on, something has changed. The patient has stopped breathing and stopped moving. I don't know what's going on. I think maybe he coded. I'm going to get us organized. I'm going to need everyone's help here. And so I directed somebody to get vital signs, get him on the monitor. And then I finished with, what else am I missing? What should I know? And one of the nurses spoke up and said, I accidentally pushed rock uranium as the flush. And so it was that explicit request for speaking up for everybody participating in the understanding that saved us. And actually, there was no problem. The patient, we just pushed the rest of the ketamine and we were already set up to intubate. So what could have been a real mess with the team not knowing what was going on, starting compressions and potentially doing invasive procedures the patient didn't need, just turned into, okay, now we know what the problem is. Now let's get on to the next task. And so that really stood out to me as a quite a useful moment to put this into action.
Yeah, that's an amazing story. And two things strike me about that. One, clearly there's also, I mean, that there's a trust in the team there already, or maybe this helped build it really quickly, that she felt like she could say that, like own up to what had happened. And I do wonder, and maybe it would not have happened if you hadn't made the space for it, right? So if you just said, look, I think they've coded and people start chest compressions and it's a lot more activation energy to kind of be like, wait, stop chest compressions. I pushed rock. But because you opened up that space, it felt maybe a little easier for her to admit that.
Exactly. And in we know that in a crisis, we need to be relatively directive in creating the team. When there's chaos, we have to be relatively strong-willed, but that can unintentionally prevent the speaking up behaviors that we need. We can never know everything that all of the other teammates know. And we really somehow need to balance the tension of being a strong organizer of the team and also explicitly getting people to continue to participate in the thinking and the speaking up and helping us know everything that we need to know.
Yeah. Well, let's kind of talk about it may seem obvious, but let's name some of the reasons why it's important to form a team quickly in these high-stakes situations. What comes to mind is why this is important?
Moments are full of times when people are coming together who often don't work together on the problem that they're facing. And there are so many uncertainties in that moment. And there are also, there's so much that needs to get done. And we can be working in a group, but not be a team. And so what we need is somebody, possibly more than one person, but at least one person who's paying attention to how all the people are working together. And are we pulling in the same direction? Do we have a shared mental model for what is actually happening right now? And what our particular role is within the context of that emergency. And so our complex healthcare situations are a daily process of teams forming and unforming and reforming. And something that's in the literature right now is the idea of smash teams, where we have two teams that are intact but get collided around a patient, like an anesthetic team and a surgical team, a trauma team, and an anesthetic team and an emergency medicine team. And we often have different ideas of what needs to be done in the moment. And if we don't get organized, then we often are pulling in different directions and not functioning effectively. And there are two big costs to this. One is patient outcomes. But the second one is when we don't feel good about the teamwork and the care that we provided, we are also victims of the bad outcome. We go home from work not feeling good, not feeling that we've done our best. And that's a tragedy that we can't afford to have in healthcare nowadays.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is really important. I think this is something people are hearing about all the time now is, you know, the importance of good communication, of good teamwork, of support, of avoiding burnout. This is another thing this can help do, right? So let's talk about name, claim, aim. What, if you had to describe it in one sentence, what would you say? What is this?
It's essentially the ABCs of teaming. And so it's so straightforward. It can be used in any kind of circumstance. It's really flexible. It's a framework. It helps bring people together really quickly in high stakes moments. And so I think it captures and encapsulates everything that's needed about a rapid teaming move in a very easy to remember mnemonic that allows for shared mental models to emerge and for speaking up to occur, just as Dr. Senek said. And it just helps people feel like they're all, instead of just a group working together, they're a team. You know, they have one, they have a goal or they have multiple goals, but they're all in alignment. And so I feel like it's essential for it's like essentials of teaming, basically.
Lana, anything you want to add to that?
I love this framing of the ABCs of teaming. You know, ABCs is helpful because it's a recipe that we all can pull on when we find a patient in crisis. It's not always exactly the right thing for what the patient needs, but it's a really helpful starting point. And I love how Rebecca described it as a supportive framework. So it's not meant to constrain you, but it is meant to support you. David Gaba and others describe the elements of crisis resource management, but how do you do them when you're overwhelmed and you're facing uncertainty and you look up and all of a sudden the room is full of people that you didn't expect to be there? And doing crisis resource management in those moments is really overwhelming, but name, claim, aim is simple. And as we talk through it, you can see that there are some elements built in that are the actions of the crisis resource management principles kind of distilled into its essence, like Rebecca said.
Yeah. And, you know, and I find with some of these simple mnemonics, right, that people, when you're telling people them, and you're, of course, you're teaching this, people are calm, they're well-rested, they're well-fed, right? You're sitting around a table and people often think, well, I don't need that. That's so simple, right? But what I always tell the trainees is, yeah, you don't need it right now, but when you are in the middle of a crisis and you are stressed and you're 20 hours into a 24-hour shift and you are hungry and you haven't slept, then your brain will freeze, right? And you will need to have something to fall back on that you can very simply go through to make sure you don't forget things. And so I think that is really key. So let's talk about some of the kind of common mistakes that happen in high pressure scenarios that would be why you need this when you are in those scenarios. Can you give me some examples of that?
So one of the common mistakes is people start doing things that make them feel comfortable and helpful. And so we walk into a room, we see a patient in crisis, and we have a particular skill set, whether we're an anesthesiologist or an emergency physician or a nurse. And we see, oh, there's an arm without an IV. I'll go put that IV in. But that might not be what the patient needs in that moment. And that might not be the right priority for our skill set. However, doing a skill that makes us feel comfortable makes us feel like an effective teammate. And so we can be potentially sucked into doing things that are actually a distraction from what the patient really needs. And so it's a trap that we fall into quite frequently, actually. So that is, as somebody helping a team, that is one of the key problems. And when we have a way of organizing and putting organization on the forefront, then we can prioritize properly for the teammates.
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense. Rebecca, anything you want to add? Any other examples?
With experts, especially, you know, you have, I saw this repeatedly when I was teaching at the Center for Medical Simulation as well, alongside Lon, that you would have people who all had a really good idea. They felt like they had a really good idea of the situation, a good handle, but then they would perform very redundant moves and leave like areas of treatment way underpopulated. And so, you know, it would be like everybody was up trying to get the airway and help each other get the airway while they didn't notice that there was no blood pressure anymore and there was no, you know, heartbeat anymore or whatever. And so, and actually what they thought they were treating was not actually what they were treating because nobody stood back and had a big picture view. So I love this because it allows for accessible, like sort of, it allows for a correct distribution of tasks. It allows for that bigger picture idea to emerge. And even in situations where, so, you know, I came from a very free thinking, I'd say, culture. And I've come into a culture that is more used to direction. And I have noticed a shift when I do use name, claim, aim, that people are thinking together. So it's not just, I think this idea that it's just hands help that we need is so, it's so bad. I always want the head with the hands. I always want the brain with the hands. So, so asking explicitly what other ideas do people have? Not are there other ideas? That's a yes, no. But what other ideas do people have is very intentional. And I think it's built into this model to allow for more of this dialogue to occur and a better picture to emerge.
Yeah. I mean, it seems to me like the expectation, you know, if the problem, right, with an expectation that the leader is going to come in and just know everything and maybe they need some sets of hands to do the things is that, you know, that is the expectation that leaders need to know everything and they cannot then draw on the expertise of the people around them.
Yes. And something that Lon said just struck me, which is that this idea of inserting uncertainty. So I think one of the failures of a team, especially when there's not this explicit model that includes a shared understanding of maybe what the situation is going on, along with dialogue around, are we correct or is there something else here? I would say that a lot of times people feel very certain about the crisis they're in, especially if it's something like hemorrhage or something like that. I found myself falling victim to this myself. Thankfully, I've learned from it, but actually by embedding this phrase and really getting a team together through inclusivity and asking questions, then you realize what you've been missing. So it's not just the one thing that you thought it was. It actually, oh, there's these other things developing because the code you start with is not always the code or the crisis that you end with. So it allows for that emergence to come into it and allows for uncertainty to be spoken where I think not a lot of people are used to hearing that maybe there is uncertainty. And I think it's really beneficial to the team to hear that too.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, and there's another common mistake that I think we bring into these moments is that we just assume teamwork will happen. We're great clinicians. We are nice people. We know the names of the people we work with. And so some dynamic situation happens and we just think, okay, we get along. We know each other. We take care of sick patients together. We'll do the team thing. But it's not as consistent as we wish it was. And so sometimes we come out of those moments kind of scratching our head saying, why didn't that go as well as we thought it would have? And a mistake is the assumption that teamwork will just happen. And we're people who work together. So we'll be a team.
Yep, absolutely. And I think you can even see almost the opposite too, which is that if you don't know anybody, it can feel like, well, I don't really know who people are and who knows what and who's in charge. And so I'm not going to say anything because I don't want to overstep or, right, like maybe you're the fellow and you're like, is there an attending here? I don't really know. Maybe I'd better not say anything, right? I mean, that can also cause the team to fall apart or to never form.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I love that. And the final mistake that, well, I shouldn't say the final, but another mistake that happens a lot to us is we assume that the operator, the person at the head of the bed, the person who's on the airway has to be the team leader or they are the team leader. And oftentimes the proceduralist can't focus on the teaming and we need somebody else to pay attention to the teaming. It might be the case that the proceduralist is overwhelmed and they shouldn't even be doing the procedure, but if they're in that setting, they really can't be, and we don't want them to be paying attention to the team. If you're dealing with a very challenging airway, and you're in the middle of your algorithm and we want you to be completely 100% focused and dedicated to that task and not looking up, not maintaining situational awareness, not trying to figure out who's going to do what in the team. So we really fall victim to the trap. This happens in emergency medicine as well. The doc at the head of the bed is the one who needs to be organizing this team because it's their case.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's so important. And I have really tried myself, if I'm the one running the code, to not also be doing the airway or the A-line or the central line or whatever. I mean, I do think that it just makes it so much easier to get the global view of what's happening and to, you know, divvy up roles. So let's talk about the name, claim, aim framework. Let's just go step by step. Let's start with name. What does that mean when we say name? What does that include?
So I can take this one. So naming is really about just narrating what you're seeing. So you want to have a succinct statement of the situation. And I believe, and I think Lon believes too, that stating your uncertainty within that name is actually really important. So I think it allows for people to sort of access their different scripts in their head about how do I treat X, Y, or Z. Now that makes sense. Even though I'm looking at the monitor and I'm a nurse and I know what an EKG looks like, that doesn't look like what I think it's supposed to look like. I can't access right now what that is. And so when somebody names, and even if they're uncertain, it gives people something to run off of and start to unlock a frozen brain, I think, is what you're saying. And so I think actually it's probably the most important step. And so I tend to teach that even if you don't remember anything else from name claiming, please just say something out loud. And so it can sound as easy as vital sign changes. I see patients hypotensive and tachycardic. I'm not sure what's going on, but we need to find out. You know, like we'll be working hard to find out. Here are the roles. Here, you know, then the rest of the claim and aim. But the naming can be as much as just vital signs with explicitly saying, I'm not sure why. And I think that that's enough. So I can share a story if that's okay.
Yeah, please.
The first time I ever used this was I was on call in the hospital and I heard stat call overhead, an emergency call. So I went to the operating room. And when I came in, I was met with a scene where it was in radiology. It was in the radiology suite, the hybrid suite. And there was the anesthesiologist, and I believe a CRNA, who were busily working on, looks like, the patient's airway. And I'm looking around and I said, how can I help? Which is my usual, you know, sort of like the routine, like, what do you need? How can I help? I'm here. And no response from them. And I correctly realized that they were just so cognitively overloaded and probably, you know, a little bit like I don't know, like, oh my God, what's going on? You know? So then I look around, I'm asking the rest of the room what's happening, and nobody's saying anything. And so I look up and, I see in the, on the monitor, I see ST segment elevations. And so I said, I'm going to try this out, guys, because the rest of the room's just looking at me. I'm the only one who's like engaging. And they knew I was from anesthesia. So I said, guys, I think this is an ST elevation MI, or there's something going on like that. And I think as soon as they're done, it looks like they're doing the airway, I can help organize us. And then I went through the claim and the aim. As soon as I said ST elevation MI, everyone in the room started being activated. The one of the nurses ran out in the hall. She's like, I'm going to go get the EKG, the 12 lead. So she brought it in. The other one is like, you want me to call the cath lab? I was like, yes, please. Like, and then the idea started flowing. Do we need nitroglycerin? Do we need aspirin? Do we need blah, blah, blah. So it was like, you know, I've got the cardiologist on the phone, and it was amazing. And it may not have been the primary problem, but it was certainly a place to start. And it actually was exactly what that patient happened to need. As soon as the people, and I had asked to Lon's earlier point about when you're the proceduralist and you know the most about the patient, sometimes you're so stuck in the activity. I had offered, in that to go like relieve them and they could step back, but I think they were too hyper-focused. But eventually they did step back, and in fact, that was what it was. But it was like really interesting to be totally in the dark, except for being able to interpret the one vital sign on the monitor. But how powerful that naming was, with just a few words, people were activated. And at least we were starting to get help in the room. Like the code cart came in the room and the defibrillator came, you know, so those kinds of things.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Do you have other things? Yeah, do you have other things to add? Anything you'd like to share?
I think I've heard people say it defibrillates the room when the room is stuck. And I love that phrase. It's a great representation of a room that's fibrillating. It's in action, but it's not really moving progressively. It's not moving blood, right? There's a lot of action taking place, and naming what you know about what's happening helps to start to organize, because now people know what their tasks are for.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, that it makes so simple, but makes so much sense why that would be so impactful. And a couple questions. So when you do this, so let's use your example, Rebecca, you come in and you say, you know, hey guys, I'm not sure what's going on, but it looks like maybe there's an ST segment elevation MI. Would you introduce yourself? Like you don't know anybody, let's just say you don't know, but would you say, you know, hey, I'm Dr. Meinhard. I'm one of the anesthesiologists. I'm not sure what's happening, but like, do you recommend that? Or do you just go straight to like, this is what I think is going on?
I mean, I think that's always helpful to share who you are and what your expertise background could be. It helps to help people build trust in you, especially if they're not placing who you are. So anytime you can use your own name or other people's names, I think that is really helpful for familiarity within the team. And so I like that addition. It's sort of like naming yourself, naming the situation.
Yeah. How about when you, I'm sure you guys must have some version of what we call an anesthesia stat, right? So this is the anesthesia team basically calls it essentially a code, right? Like, we need help right now. And everybody comes. So you're in an OR and all of a sudden you get like, you know, 8 attendings and everybody else. Everybody's showing up. If you're one of those attendings showing up, like, you know, you walk in the room, you don't really know, like, are people already, it looks like a lot of people are already doing some stuff. Like, do you try to say at that point, like in that scenario, would you say, hey, you know, I mean, you probably know everyone if it's your OR area, so you may not need to introduce yourself, but you could, and then say like, I am not sure what's going on, but it looks like we have a patient whose airway has been lost. Like, does that make sense?
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And I think even when it feels a little bit like, well, gosh, everybody should know this, it's sort of obvious to everyone. Am I overstating the obvious? I just think that you can't overstate that. You have people coming in and out of the room constantly during a crisis. You know, there are nurses and surgeon and surgical helpers, whatever, coming in and out with equipment or with people trying to understand the situation. And I don't think you can say enough what the evolving situation is. I mean, even if you were to say we're it looks like they've moved to front of neck access for the airway attempt. You know, guys, I think we should be thinking about next steps. Like, I think you can even help them plan ahead, with, I think it's always a delicate balance when you're trying to come in and organize a team that you are just on the scene for at the beginning. So I think especially using those qualifiers of like, it looks to me like I'm going to try this out. Let me give it a shot. You know, I think Right. Those are really helpful to help with the dynamic in the room already.
Yeah. And so doing this helps because it kind of gets everybody on the same page, right? It creates a shared mental model. This is what we think is happening. Other people could say, well, actually, you know, this or that, right? You can all chime in, but it's doing that. And is there other things, like, I mean, are there things we know that this does in terms of helping us move forward?
When there's a little bit of context that's contributing, it helps to direct how are we going to organize the team? So the flow is what's happening, how are we going to organize, and who's doing what, and what are our priorities? What's our big picture? And you can't understand how you're supposed to organize until you understand what's happening. There's a lot of emergencies that are simultaneous dual emergencies. We have cardiac arrest from a lost airway. Well, we've got two problems here. And the best team in that setting splits the team. One team focuses on cardiac resuscitation and one team focuses on the airway resuscitation. And so when we understand our context and what is actually happening, then it helps us to understand how to organize. And a lost airway in CAT scan is such a different beast than a lost airway in the OR. And a lost airway in my rural hospital, where I'm the only physician in the hospital, is such a different beast than a lost airway in the OR at MGH. And so if there is important context, putting that in the naming helps the team to organize and figure out what the next steps are.
And I can absolutely see this really helping reduce the kind of cognitive load for the different members of the team. Because if I'm, you know, if someone hasn't done this and I'm doing the airway and I'm also trying to think about, okay, wait a minute, but what are we supposed to be doing for the cardiac arrest? And is there another line that we need? But if someone is saying, listen, you have got the airway, right? Like, here's what's going on. And this, of course, gets us into the claim of how we're going to divvy up those roles. So let's talk about that. What does the claim part of this mean? Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hey, folks, this episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. You know, as Valentine's Day gets close, sometimes it can feel like everyone else has it all together in their love lives. Whether you're married, dating, or single, the truth is most of us are still figuring it out and finding our way. And no matter where you are in your romantic journey, therapy can help you find your way. I know it's made a huge difference for me and my wife over the years and for many other couples that we know. Sometimes you need help to figure out what's weighing your relationship down or holding you back from finding a new relationship. And BetterHelp can help. With over 30,000 therapists, BetterHelp is one of the world's largest online therapy platforms, having served over 5 million people globally. And it works. With an average rating of 4.9 out of 5 for a live session based on over 1.7 million client reviews, BetterHelp does the initial matching work for you so you can focus on your therapy goals. And with 12 plus years of experience, they typically get it right the first time. And if you aren't happy with your match, switch to a different therapist at any time from their tailored recs. BetterHelp makes it easy to get matched online with a qualified therapist. Sign up and get 10% off at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com. Hey, ACRackers, it's the new year and you want to eat better, but you have zero time and zero energy to make it happen. Factor doesn't ask you to meal prep or follow recipes. It just removes the entire problem. 2 minutes, real food, done. My wife and I used to feel like we were failing at healthy eating for our family, and you may feel that way too. But you aren't failing at healthy eating. You're failing at having 2 or 3 extra hours every night to cook. That's why I use Factor and you should too. We're talking meals designed by dietitians and crafted by chefs. Deliver to your door, heat for 2 minutes, and eat. Inside, you'll find exactly what you would have made if you had the time. Lean proteins, colorful veggies, whole foods, and healthy fats. No refined sugars, no artificial sweeteners, no refined seed oils. It's always fresh, never frozen. My kids think Factor tastes like restaurant food, and honestly, they're right. With 100 rotating weekly meals and the new Muscle Pro collection to support strength and recovery, it's no wonder people love it. I wouldn't have believed it until I tried it, and now I can't get enough. Get Factor if you want all the flavor and none of the fuss. Head to factormeals.com/ACRAC50OFF and use code ACRAC50OFF to get 50% off your first Factor box plus free breakfast for a year. This offer is only valid for new Factor customers with the code and qualifying auto-renewing subscription purchase. Make healthier eating easy with Factor. Hey folks, a well-built wardrobe is about pieces that work together and hold up over time. That's what Quince does best. Premium materials, thoughtful design, and everyday staples that feel easy to wear and easy to rely on, even as the weather shifts. Quince has the everyday essentials I love with quality that lasts. Organic cotton sweaters, polos for every occasion, lighter jackets that keep you warm in the changing seasons. The list goes on. Quince works directly with top factories and cuts out the middlemen, so you don't have to pay for brand markup, just quality clothing. Everything is built to hold up to daily wear and still look good season after season. Each piece is made from premium materials by trusted factories that meet rigorous standards for craftsmanship and ethical production. I absolutely love the zip-up fleece I got from Quince, and my wife and three daughters, who are all about fashion and not afraid to criticize my clothing, are all fans. Refresh your wardrobe with Quince. Go to quince.com/ACRAC for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada, too. That's quince.com/ACCRAC. Free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/ACRAC. Hey there, ACRACers. It takes heart to build bodies that break records. Over the past 6 years, a team of incredible healthcare professionals did what most people thought was impossible. They rebuilt the body of legendary Olympian Lindsey Vonn after a series of devastating injuries forced her into early retirement. Now she's headed to the 2026 Winter Games, ready to break records once again. This February in Milan, Lindsey's team and the entire USA medical team will be wearing FIGS. You can rock their official uniform too. The new Team USA collection from FIGS is engineered with FiberX, their most durable fabric yet. FiberX is setting the new gold standard for high-performance scrubwear. It's lightweight, breathable, and ultra-resilient. And of course, the styles come in red, white, and blue. Check out the limited edition Team USA collection and get 15% off your first order at wearfigs.com with codes FIGSRX. That's wearfigs.com, code FIGSRX.
All right, and we're back.
Yeah, the claim is really what is my role going to be in this moment? And it is designed to empower us. One of the challenges for us is feeling that we deserve to be the resuscitation team event organizer, especially early in our career. Some of us take that claim easier than others. But this is designed to help the team understand that our job now is to be the organizer or the event manager. It also helps us recognize that that's our job so that we can focus, okay, my job is paying attention to the team in this moment and getting us organized. And I think the words don't just help those around us, but they help us. One of the most difficult, elements for a team to process is uncertainty, and social uncertainty is a really, really big tax on our teams. Who's in charge? I mean, we've all seen the teams where the rooms where it's chaos and somebody just says, who's in charge? And that defibrillates the team and somebody claims themselves as in charge, and that just changes the whole dynamic. And so we are trying to create that as the claim as a reliable part. It feels a little bit awkward because it's not normal that we will walk into a room and say, I think this is Nesty Elevation MI. I'm going to get this group organized. So it definitely feels socially awkward, but it actually really downregulates the social uncertainty of all the other team players. And then they can start to focus on what their job is going to be because they know how we're going to relate to one another.
Yeah. I love that. I have this very, very it's an embarrassing memory, but I remember as an intern, I can't remember if it must have been some sort of simulated scenario and we were supposed to be kind of like taking turns coming to a code. And I think I'd heard someone do this. And so I had kind of had it in my head. So I come in, you know, to the room and I kind of said, all right, you know, my name is Jed Wolpaw and I'm running this code. And my co-interns like just laughed and made fun of me for it. Right. But like, and I think about that back and how embarrassed I was, but but I think that's not the worst idea. But maybe you would ask, you know, if you came into a room and there were already a lot of people there, is, like you said, is anyone, you know, who's in charge or who's running the code? And if nobody says anything, you can say, okay, like, let me help out by trying to get us organized. Does that make sense?
So totally.
Lana's nodding. Yeah, okay.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, Rebecca.
And, I also, this sort of goes into the aims a little bit, but when we decide on actions and we assign roles, so like for example, in usually when I'm teaching this, we're teaching with a checklist, like an event manager checklist or an organizer checklist, where it's like, think about somebody who can do IVs and do medications, defibrillator, blah, 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 and it's pretty extensive. It allows people, especially if you're encouraging people to self-claim roles, it allows people to sort of showcase what they can do instead of what they might have trouble doing. So I think along with this assignment of roles and the uncertainty that comes with it is sometimes I don't always know who's in the room and what their skill sets are. And so I think the claiming part can be kind of tough. And so I do teach my teams to, as much as possible, if you hear, and this is where when I do name, claim, aim, I might combine claim and aim and ask for volunteers, basically, like, who can do an IV for me, you know, who's an experienced, because that's actually, like, it seems like a straightforward skill, but actually can be the most critical and a difficult skill to have. So maybe I want a senior person doing that rather than my CA1 or, you know. So it's nice when you can promote people to speak up about their own comfort and skill sets, and that actually helps the organizer or the team really reduce that, their cognitive load about trying to find the right people for the right jobs. So,
yeah. And, you know, it seems like one of the real components I'm hearing from you guys about this that's so important is expressing that uncertainty, right? You are not the all-knowing, all-powerful, right? You're just taking a role, which is trying to organize things. And so saying something like, you know, I don't know everyone in the room. I'm not sure what everyone's, you know, roles are or what everyone's skill set is. Is there someone who could get an IV? Is there someone who could start chest compressions? Is there someone who can, you know, try to get an A-line, you know, whatever it is. And then let that both, first of all, be, you know, an expression of humility. Like, I don't know, I'm asking for your help again, because we already did that in the name, right? Of saying like, I'm not sure what's going on. I would love to hear input from everyone. This is what I'm seeing. So each step of the way, you're kind of sharing your uncertainty and therefore inviting others to give their input.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So the claim, we hear different versions of it. Some people will say, I'll run this code. Some people will say, I'll be the event manager. That's what they do at the Brigham. Some people will say, I'd like to get us organized. Sometimes trainees will say, I'll be in charge until my attendant gets here. And so there's a lot of good versions of this, but it's directed outwards. What can you expect from me? And also inwards, what is my role in this moment? It also starts to establish a culture for the team of explicit communication. And so we typically teach the claim to sound something like, I'm going to get us organized and I'll need everyone's help. Okay. And so Oftentimes you're required to say okay twice. Because people won't say anything, they'll nod. And what that does is it starts to create the dynamic on this team that I expect is closed loop communication. And so I kind of playfully teach this as you're the flight attendant and everybody else is in, and everybody on the team is in the emergency exit, and they have to give you visual and auditory okay, that, and it's your job to make eye contact with them, because that's how you're going to communicate in the future too. So you're kind of creating the norms for the team within just 10 seconds. And we like to think that our culture is established, but culture is established actually within every resuscitation. And this is an opportunity for you as the organizer to say, you know, the way I want this team to work is, everybody's going to contribute. We're going to be explicit about our roles. We're going to close the loop. I'm going to use eye contact. I expect you to respond. If you can't do something, please tell me. So all of these things we can create in the moment for our team.
Yeah. So a little twist on this that can come up in, let's say, in academic centers, right? And I wonder how you would recommend approaching this. Let's say you as the attending show up, your trainee, whoever, resident fellow, whatever, is already there. They've taken this organizer role. And you're like, okay, you know, let them, they seem like, all right, let me let them do this. I'm here. But then you notice that maybe they're not doing it well, or they're giving some directions that are not what you think is the right move. How do you respond in a way that is not going to, you know, destroy their confidence, but of course you need to do what's right for the patient?
So one of the things, and I'd love to hear what Lon does himself, but one of the things we used to do is offer up to be like a code whisperer or a muse or something like that. So just to go up and to say, I want to support you. Do you want to just like discuss with me and can I help you think through the things and what's on your mind that you think is going on? So it's this person can remain the outward facing and you're just there to support them. So I've seen a lot of that dynamic explicitly played out on in teams that have sort of more of that, like maybe in medicine, for example, the code teams for medicine, they'll have the attending there actually like promoting the senior, the med senior to be the leader of the code. And I think that's a beautiful way to explicitly teach these skills and support a trainee who needs to learn them. I mean, the attendings don't, it's hard for the attendings to learn them and we need to still be developing our own skills. And in some ways, it's like actually really wonderful if you can help support a trainee to do this too, because they're going to need to go out and do these things as well. Lon, what do you do?
I think that's great. The one piece I would just add on to that is sometimes you go in and you see somebody who's overwhelmed and giving them choices and options. And sometimes it might look like I've made several suggestions and they haven't been implemented. And so if in my assessment, they are overwhelmed, I might say, hey, I'm wondering if it would be okay if I took over and ran this for now. And I want you beside me to help me. And so potentially depending on how they appear to be coping, that would just be the one nuance I would add to it. But that is my default. Hey, I'd love to support you. My job here is to coach you. I'm going to be right next to you, but you're in charge. And so the failure mode for me is when I start giving orders to the team and then it's not clear who's in charge, instead of helpful nudges to the person who's trying to run the room.
Yeah, I love that. I have this, when I started as an attending, an anesthesia attending, I was so determined to not be that attending who took procedures away from residents, right? And so I would let residents, I have this memory, I'd let residents try forever on things, not on airways, obviously, but, on things like A-lines. And so I have this memory of one day, just the resident, it must have been 45 minutes, this resident is going after this A-line. And I was like, I'm not going to step in. And finally, I just kind of said to the resident, like, do you mind if I take a shot? And the look of relief on their face was so profound. It completely, I realized I was way overdoing it. I was actually, making residents feel like they had to keep going long past when they wanted help, right? And so that completely changed my practice about this and how I handle it. But I think the same thing could be true here, right? You may be thinking, oh, I don't want to hurt their feelings or make them feel like I'm pushing them aside. But if they're overwhelmed, and you could probably tell, they may be actually incredibly grateful if you step in a kind way.
Yeah.
And I had an exact experience like that, Jed. So you're in good company. So
Yeah. It's fine. I always tell, when my like CA3s come to me, they're like, how do you make the adjustment to being an attending? And I was like, well, look, you're going to do one of two things around like that. You're either going to step in very quickly because you're very nervous and you don't want anything bad to happen, or you're going to do what I did, which is never want to step in because you don't want to be the attending who steals the procedures, right? And then you will moderate and you'll find the middle some one way or the other.
Yeah. Do you want your knots too long or too short?
Sir? Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. All right. So we've talked about the claim. Let's go to the aim. What does that mean? And let's go through that.
So I like the aim to be the first three things that you can think of. So this is where you're going to start to plant seeds of like, what are the action steps that the team needs to take to get the goals met? And so the aim might look a little different. I don't know how Lon's interpretation of this, mine has evolved over time. And so I often will pair the claim and the aim. So I'll say like, I think we need to establish IV access. We need to call the blood bank and get the massive transfusion protocol activated. And we need to get the code card outside the room or inside the room. And so who can do the, who's our blood runner? Who's our IV person, who can fetch the code card? Oh, yes, you, whatever. And so, and then what are other ideas? So the thing about it is to not overload the room with all of the laundry list of things that need to occur in the very moment, but just to start people off. And, as you're starting off, then the ideas will start to flow and then you'll get sort of the most important things addressed. And so I do think this is a skill to practice. So I often will have people practice in a certain emergency situation, what are the critical things and what would you ask the first three things done to be? And so I think this is something best done outside of a crisis, like all of our preparation, basically. But this is where, for example, like emergency manuals can really help and drill people into like, you know, remembering the first three things immediately and then being able to practice them. And then the rest comes. So, Lon, what are your thoughts about this too?
I think that's beautiful. And it's all about the big picture. So things that need to be done. And you have this statement, like Dr. Meinhard said, that what else am I missing? And you can contextualize it because our big goal here is X, Y, and Z. Then it helps people to speak up. If our big goal is X, Y, and Z, then we are missing this step. And it brings us to another failure mode for teams is we want the leader to think of everything. And it feels really great for us to offload all the thinking to the leader. But if the leader demands that we participate in the thinking part and they give us the big picture view of where we're trying to head, then we can contribute in a meaningful way. I'm thinking about epinephrine and how contextual the dosing of epinephrine is. And it's quite common that we see teams say, okay, give some epi. But if we don't connect why we're giving the epi, you know, if we think this is last, we want to give a different dose of epi, even if it's a ventricular arrhythmia. And there are many other cases where you guys are going to titrate epi. If you're in the emergency department and you ask for epi, you're pretty likely to get 1 milligram of IV epi, regardless of what's happening with the patient, unless you're very clear about why you're doing it. And so, you know, in your wisdom as somebody with experience, you're going to be able to titrate this, but a lot of times you need to give like a little bit of the big picture why we're doing what we're doing in the aim part.
Yeah. So you're kind of identifying where do I think we're going? What are some of the key things we're going to try to do? And then how are we going to get there? You know, who's got a role in these things? And then what else? What am I missing? Right. I need your brains too. Right. So if you were, let's say, in the situation, you know, with, you think it's last, right. You want to like, just take us through what you would say, Lon.
Yeah. So this is great. We'll be teaching our pain fellows next week. So we run this. So I would say something like, folks, let's just stop where we're at. We just saw a change in ventricular rhythm and it looks like we're in the middle of giving our celiac plexus block. I'm making something up.
Sure.
It may be silly. I think we should stop what we're doing and I'd like to get us organized. I'm thinking we're going to need to everyone's help. Okay. I think the next things are, let's recheck a blood pressure. Can we get a pulse? And we need to consider the differential for this ventricular rhythm change. Could be last, could be other things. What else should I be thinking about? So that might be one example of how to do it.
Yep. Love that. And again, such an open approach. You know, what I love about it, we often think that openness is disorganized, right? It's kind of like loose. So it's like, I don't know, guys, what are we going to do, right? And this approach is both tight and open, right? It's actually really unique in that it's both. It's organized, it gets things moving, but it is also open to input.
And I think it's easier to do when you're at my stage in my career. So I'm like 20 years in, 25 years in. And so I want to just give a nod to the fact that what you just said, Jed, is so important in the whole, in teaching this. So when you think about how people build trust in the OR, one half of it is competence. How are they demonstrating their competence? And so that means they're actually like reliable, they're capable, you know, their capabilities are there. And then, you know, the other half is like their intention. But when you're talking about competence and you're also demonstrating uncertainty and openness to other people's ideas, I think sometimes it leaves somebody feeling very vulnerable. I know I certainly felt vulnerable in initially saying these things because I didn't want people to think I had no idea what was going on. I just didn't know right then. And so I felt like adding on phrases, we don't know right this moment what it is, but we will assure you, you know, we will find out. So those kinds of things, I think help ease that that fear of looking completely incompetent while you need, because you need to be open, you need to be accepting. When I haven't been open in my resuscitations to other people's ideas, I miss big things. And that's just the, that's true for everybody I know. So it doesn't go away.
Yeah. You know, absolutely. So, you know, as you said, this is, can be challenging to do this, right? Especially maybe for more junior people. So how can someone who's thinking, yeah, I want to do this, but maybe how do I ease myself in? How do I start practicing this? What advice do you give them?
So in our anesthesia courses, we've started to teach this by having just rapid cycle deliberate practice of just the skill of name, calling name. So a very short stem. And then what would I say with this very short stem? And so that can be a really helpful way of just practicing. If the patient were to have X, Y, and Z right now, what would I say to the team? The other thing is we don't want to rehearse it and only use it in our most difficult moments. Number one, we don't have that many crises. So instead of viewing this as a process to use during a crisis, if we view it as a process to use when we're in a team, we have a lot of teaming moments. Just getting ready for a case, just starting our day, just organizing who's going to do what rooms today. For my family, figuring out what restaurant you're going to eat at in Disney World. And so we're surrounded by team moments. And when we look up and we think all these people need to come together to make progress towards a shared goal, I think we want to think that's when I need to pull out name, claim, name. And when we practice it in the low stakes moments, running a meeting or like I said, I gave some other examples, it's going to be available for us when we need it. But if we save it for crises, we're not going to be able to pull it out then.
Yeah. I love practicing it in kind of everyday life. I've got a house full of girls. I've got three daughters and it is like, you know, half the time someone's hurt someone's feelings and someone's mad and someone's crying and so, right. And just, I love it. This is such a good thing to use. Like, let me just name what I'm seeing, right? I'm neutral. I just got home. Let me name what I'm seeing. All right. This is what I'm going to try to get us organized about how to like go through. You're going to tell your side. You're going to tell your side. You're right. What do we need? What else do we need to do? It really is similar and can be really helpful.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
I have fallen victim to using my sim techniques at home and my wife doesn't always appreciate it. But if you tell them that you're practicing something, then I think they give you a little bit of grace.
Nice. I love that. So you can practice in non-crisis situations. You can practice in everyday situations. And this will help you be ready for the crises when they come. And you'll have already kind of been going through this.
But I think a common teaching modality is you're behind the curtains. Everything's going well. And you pull to a page in the crisis manual and you ask the resident, what would you do if we went through, you know, the patient started to get, you know, malignant hyperthermia or whatever, if you incorporate this into that, so what would you say to the room?
Yeah, perfect.
Then that's a great opportunity to practice it.
That's what I was going to say. And then the other thing is just to train your brain. So I think the thing that a lot of people may have trouble initially with is narrating what they're seeing. So narrating what I'm seeing is a very different skill that I've had to develop over time, because it's not just like putting it in my head, you know, like looking with my eyes and hearing with my ears and then like thinking about it. It's actually just like coming right back out my mouth so that I learn how to real time kind of put together and get used to speaking out loud when I'm still putting together a circumstance. And so that's, I think to have people, like I will have residents in the operating room, I'll just say, narrate what you see on the monitor. And so what do you think are the most important? Like if you look at this monitor, what are the most important things if suddenly we have this situation are, and what would you narrate? How would you do that? So it just gives them those, like it's kind of on the spot a little bit, but that's how a crisis happens. You know, and it's nice because then we can actually, I can coach to it, you know, and we can have a debrief about it a little bit. So.
Yep. I love that. Yeah. You know, it is, I haven't thought about that, but I love what you both just said, which is this idea that if we said, I think for sure, if tomorrow in the OR, I said to my resident, what if the patient went into cardiac arrest? What would you do? They would be like, I would call for help. I would start giving epinephrine. I would get, you know, if it was a VTAC or VFib, I would get the defibrillator on, right, in shock. But they would not say, I would name, claim, aim, right? But that is such an important part and kind of makes the rest go better.
Yeah, for sure.
Rebecca, I'm putting you on the spot here, but you did some really interesting research on what anesthesiologists view as a crisis.
Oh, and
what,
thank you.
Like what a trigger is for using this potentially. If like what do anesthesiologists use as triggers for, you know, pausing the room and starting to go into something like this formally?
Yeah. Thank you so much for asking this. So this is work that is yet unpublished, but will be submitted again, or will be submitted for the first time because we've been working on it for qualitative research, which always takes like so much longer than you think it's going to take.
But you heard it first on ACRAC.
Yes, delightful. And so basically what's really fascinating is that we asked like 91 anesthesiologists, like practicing anesthesiologists, what are the elements of a crisis and what would trigger them to do this? And it's a lot of emotional load. So people feel panic, people feel fear. They were very honest about, their emotional state of things. They also had cognitive things like, you know, when they felt either their brain was frozen or they felt like too many thoughts, too many things to do. They couldn't see the trajectory where things were going. They felt very uncertain about the situation. Then, those were the times when we were trying to get them to think about triggering this name, claim, aim, to just take a breath and trigger and start to, those are the moments. So when they call it a crisis is that, and it was really interesting because it is definitely different. It depends on the culture of the place. It depends on the skill set of the anesthesiologist. And so, there were some modifications, about whether they'd been in that situation before and where they could like mark out a timeline for what they thought was going to happen next. But overall, it's like something that is unfolding too fast with not enough resources to meet the need. And so I really like that definition. And I like, you know, I like normalizing the fact that like if you're feeling like it's a crisis, then it has some valid points to it. Whether or not, you know, afterwards you feel like, well, I missed something and maybe I should have caught this or whatever. In the moment, you didn't know. And that's the most important part. And what you're doing by initiating this whole name, claim, aim is you're calling attention to the need for a dramatic increase in resources and a dramatic increase in information that you just can't get by yourself. It's just impossible for nearly anyone, I would argue.
Yep. Fabulous. All right. This has been such a great conversation. Lots of great examples. I hope people are going to walk away from this and start doing this in their everyday life and for sure in their work life. Any last wrap-up comments you each want to make before we move on?
I love this work. I think we need to be doing more of this work. I think it's really hard work to do. So thank you to everyone who's like, we've built this on the backs of many, many greats. And I feel so honored to be part of this. And thank you so much for having us. I'm so grateful for that as well.
Of course. Lon?
Yeah, I think, each person has to develop their own voice and what being a resuscitation leader looks like to you. And we can make that process faster if we know what to say. Then we can start focusing on how do we want to come across. But it's too much to do both of those at the same time. And so I think you don't have to be perfect at name, claim, aim. If you just start somewhere, then you will be able to get a little bit of momentum in your team. And you'll also start to be able to think, well, if I can just name what's happening, then I can think about how do I want to come across as a team leader in this moment or as a team member in this moment. And I think this is hopefully a tool for each person developing their really unique voice in a resuscitation.
Yeah, awesome. And Lon, I know you do some MOCA training programs and you incorporate this into them, I assume?
Yeah, this is a big part of our MOCA training. So last year we did 24 MOCA training programs at CMS. And so they're a couple most months. And people can get their 20 plus 5 ABA CME credits. And also their, as of next year, we'll be able to offer people their... they get 7.5 hours of AMA level one credits and also their SENs, patient safety credits. Nice. So it's a really efficient program. So if people are interested in seeing what we do, they can come to our website and see about our programs or reach out to us.
Fabulous. And we'll put the link to that program in the show notes. All right. This has been fabulous. Let's turn to the portion of our show where we make random recommendations. I'm going to ask you each to recommend something the audience check out for fun. Lon, you want to start?
I just reread, we just adopted a new dog, and I reread this book called The Other End of the Leash, which is a really interesting book about the psychology of us and how we relate to our animals. And it has triggered this this idea in my mind that we probably should write a book called Everything I Learned About Simulation. I learned from training my dog, but it's a short read. It's by a PhD animal behavior and human psychologist, and she has just a great spirit to her. So if you're interested in dog training, it's a good recommendation.
Nice. Well, this is not a dog training book, but it is a very dog centered book. I've recommended it before, but on the show. But it's called The Art of Racing in the Rain. Have you ever heard of that book?
Mm-mm.
Oh, it's a fabulous book. A friend recommended it to me maybe a year ago, and I read it, loved it. I shouted it out on the podcast a while back. But The Art of Racing in the Rain is a really sweet, wonderful, easy read. But it has a dog as one of the main. It's kind of told through the eyes of a dog, so it's really, really a nice book. Rebecca, how about you?
Yes. So I've been returning to my roots as far as like reclaiming recipes from my grandparents. So on one side, my grandparents were Ukrainian, but they grew up along the Polish border. And I found, when they immigrated, I lived in Charleroi, Pennsylvania, which is a really like poor coal mining town. So I just discovered coalregion.com, and it has recipes, and they are exactly my grandmother's recipes. And so I'm really excited to make like pierogies and halupkis and other things that if people have those roots, it's there. So I would totally recommend checking it out. And it's been a really fun activity to do with my kids, too.
That's awesome. Very cool. Well, I'm going to recommend a book I am about two-thirds of the way done with, but I do feel confident already that I can recommend it. It's Dan Brown's new book called Secret of Secrets. For those who don't know, Dan Brown wrote The Da Vinci Code. That was kind of his breakout book, and he's written some books since. But this book is both a very typical, like, fun, page-turner, gripping kind of suspense novel, but also it is blowing my mind in this theory it talks about, which is a real theory of non-local consciousness. This idea that what if our consciousness doesn't exist in our brain? It's like a force that's all around us, just like gravity, but our brains are evolved to tune into it. And just all the implications of that, it's so fascinating to think about. So check it out, Dan Brown's Secret of Secrets. All right, Rebecca and Lon, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
All right. Hopefully you got as much out of that as I did. That was really fantastic. Let us know what you thought. Go to the website, acrack.com, where you can leave a comment. Others can learn from what you have to say. If you are a fan of the show, you can follow us. We're on Twitter. We are on Facebook. We are on Reddit. And we are on Instagram. I'm at Jay Wolpaw on Twitter, and we're at ACRAC Podcast, and you can find us on all those other platforms as well. If you are a fan of the show, please consider going to Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts and leaving a comment and a rating. It really helps others find the show. If you'd like to support the making of the show, please consider going to patreon.com/ACRAC. That's patreon.com/ACRAC, where you can become a patron of the show. Even if it's just a dollar or two that you pledge, it makes a big difference, and we really appreciate it. You can also make donations anytime by going to paypal.me/ACRAC or looking up Jay Wolpaw on Venmo. Thank you so much to those who have already made donations and become patrons. We really appreciate it. Thanks, as always, to our fantastic ACRAC crew. Sonia Amanat is our tech lead. Taylor Duggan, William Mao, and Rachel Furman are our production assistants and social media managers. Thanks so much for all you do. Our original ACRAC music is by Dr. Dennis Kuo. You can check out his website at studymusicproject.com. All right. That is it for today. For the ACRAC podcast, I'm Jed Wolpaw. Thanks for listening. Remember, what you're doing out there every day is really important and valued.